Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Emily LeBeau-Lucchesi, the author of This Is Really War, the incredible true story of a Navy nurse POW in the occupied Philippines. Emily, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to talk to you.
So I'm hoping, so this is a new book of yours that just came out in May, in the beginning of May. And so I'm hoping you can start out by talking a little bit about how you got interested in this topic of nurse POWs during World War II and what drew you to writing this book.
So I had heard of the Army nurses in Bataan. And these were the Army nurses who were known as the Angels of Bataan because they set up in field hospitals and they provided care to American and Filipino forces during the U.S. and Filipino defense that eventually and quite quickly was lost to the invading Japanese Army. But I never heard of their Navy nurse counterparts. And I found a memoir on the top shelf of my library written by one of the Navy nurses. And it was written in the 1990s. It's out of print. And I brought it home. And the memoir itself was highly problematic because the author changed names. She wanted to be honest about everybody, but she didn't want to embarrass anyone. Even though many of the other women were long gone, she wanted to protect them. So she changed names, and then she used a lot of dialogue, which you cannot do in a historical document. So I loved the nurse that was Nurse Dorothy Still. I absolutely loved her. I loved her voice. I found her to be so honest, but I did not like the book. It was not a historical document, and it also made her sound a little bit like she was roughing it at summer camp, when in all actuality, she was in a concentration camp. And I found out later from her son why she presented it in such a lighter manner.
So what sort of drew you then? So you put this book together to get at not only sort of her story seems to be the sort of thread that weaves it all together, but you introduce us to this whole sort of backdrop of figures and characters and nurses. So what sort of drew you to all, not only her story, but these others as well?
So these 12 women, or as they're referred to in the book, the 12 anchors, because they were essentially the anchors of these concentration camps. They stopped helpless and desperate inmates from drifting. Just by providing medical care. And even if they didn't have medical care, they provided comfort. And I was so amazed by these women because they shouldn't have been taken prisoner of war. They should have been repatriated as medical corps under the Geneva Convention, but instead they were sent to a civilian concentration camp. And once they were there, they were under no obligation to maintain rank as military women and to continue nursing. They could have laid in bed all day if they had wanted to. They were under no obligation, and they also weren't under any agreement to be paid for their work. And yet, out of duty, they reported to this makeshift infirmary and provided medical care, comfort. And for many people, they were the anchor. They were the only ones they had. Because people reported to these civilian camps, they were told to go bring 1 week's worth of clothing. It's just registration. If you are a citizen of any of our enemy countries, you have to register and then we'll release you. And that, of course, was a trick. So you had some people who, you know, let's say you were an American, but you married a Filipina. Well, she was allowed to remain in Manila, but you had to report to the camp. So that you had people who were separated from their family, or maybe women who had married minors who their husbands joined the military and they were sent to the camp. You know, just different reasons why people were alone, except they had these Navy nurses. And I was so in awe of how heroic they were and how their story had never been fully told. And I thought that needed to be changed. They've appeared in other books about the Army nurses, Angels of Bataan, but they were never given their own story. And I thought, I want to tell this story because I want to change the way we look at women as heroes and we look at women in their placement of war. Because we often forget as a society that women were there. And these women, they were on the front lines, right? They were at the bombing of Cavite. They were the ones providing care in overcrowded wards. They were the ones who were caring for civilians. They were there and they never received their due as heroes. And that's what I'm seeking to change.
And so you set this up in a really interesting, you put it in five parts. And so you start with 1941. So you sort of bring us right in, sort of right before the attack on Pearl Harbor. So can you talk a little bit about that first year in 1941 and why you started there?
So I started in 1941 because it allowed me to position these nurses, or they're in the Philippines. And when all of them initially get their assignment to the Philippines, they're all on different assignments. They're told it's a very good assignment. And I wanted to stress this, that the nurses, because it was so warm, they only worked a half shift. And so they were told, pack a lot of party dresses. You'll have time for dances and tennis and golf and swimming. And so that was kind of an assurance for these women who were from, you know, some of them were from South Dakota, from Iowa, one from Chicago, a couple from Southern California, that these are women from all over the country and they're going halfway around the world. And it's very intimidating. And it starts out nice. And then you have the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And 3 days later, the bombing of Cavite. And what I want to stress in this part of the book is how the U.S. was truly not ready for war in 1941, right? So you have the U.S. at the time is described as a peacetime army. It is the 17th largest in the world. When it comes to war weaponry, planes, ships, other artillery, we're not there. And this is so key because General MacArthur, after the attack, he plows ahead with what was called Plan Orange. And Orange Plan, or, you know, I'm failing the name off the top of my head, War Plan Orange would have been very well done if they had backup in terms of troops and food. But the U.S. did not have that because after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt met with Winston Churchill and he met with the Secretary of War for the U.S. and they decided, because Churchill was pressing for a Europe first approach, they agreed to come back to the South Pacific later. And because the Admiral, I guess just what I want to stress is that because the Admiral did not agree with War Plan Orange and with MacArthur, and because backup was not coming, after the bombing of Cavite, the Admiral took most of his fleet to the Dutch East Indies, and they did not bring the Navy nurses. So these women were essentially abandoned by the Navy.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was just going to say it was really interesting. You have, I think it's the second chapter in that section that you entitle it, "Oh My God, This Is Really War," right? It seemed that there was this idea that the war was going on around them, but not that, but they weren't really going to interact with it. I don't know if that's the best way to say it. And that they were really like, you know, go outside and see that there are air raids and we're getting bombed and this is really a war.
It's interesting that line comes from Nurse Margaret Nash, who went by the name of Peg, and readers will love her. She's one of my, the title of the book comes from her. So many other things come from her. She was this lively, vivacious young woman from Pennsylvania who at the end of the war weighed 68 pounds. And so the nurses say they thought they were safe. Everybody thought the Philippines was safe because the U.S. was there. So you actually had people transferring in from other Asian countries thinking, well, Japan would be foolish to attack the U.S. And so they knew there was war in Europe, but they didn't think it would happen to them. And it did.
Right. And they start out by sort of in that section, too, you talk about sort of Dorothy and Peg recording notes and sort of taking notes of what's going on. And they're still sort of and doing the everyday things. They're sort of exhausted and tired, but they're sort of doing what they need to do. And they haven't gotten to the point where they have realized that this is going to be, they're in it for the long haul, right? This still seems to be something where they're.
Okay. So Dorothy, at that point, she was only about 2 weeks away from going back to the States. She had done her 2 years in the Philippines. And so, and there were several of their nurses. There was a nurse from Chicago. She was engaged and the Navy didn't allow nurses to be married. So she'd actually sent home all of her belongings. She had her boat ticket home. So someone like Dorothy, she thought she was not going to be in the hostilities for long. And then someone like Peg was engaged. So her wedding was planned for February of 1942. And at that point, the Navy was going to send her home. So these women had their lives planned. And then, of course, they were taken prisoner of war. Peg's wedding never happened because both her and her fiancé were prisoners of war at the time.
Right. So then you move us. So they've got, you know, Pearl Harbor happens. There's really war happening around them. And so then you bring us into 1942 and you start out with Dorothy sort of being on the rooftop. It's New Year's Eve, sort of admiring the lights and that, you know, there was a, Manila became an open city, and so there were people coming in and out of the hospital. So can you bring us into sort of 1942 and what's going on during that time?
So by 1942, the nurses had been evacuated out of Cavite after the bombing of the naval base. And so they go into these makeshift hospitals all across the city. And hers is... The Navy eventually moves them all to a former women's music college. And that's where they are when they're taken prisoner of war. So 1942 starts with them standing on the roof and they're looking at the city because the lights are back on. The blackout has been ended. The Japanese are coming. They're taking over the city. And so it's kind of their last moment. And so... they have scotch on the rocks and they just toast each other and to the new year, whatever that might bring. And the next day they are taken prisoner of war in what is initially a very calm transaction. You know, someone knocks on the door, says, "Everybody here is a prisoner of war. We want a list of names, rank, military affiliation, that kind of thing." And then as the weeks progress, it gets hostile and violent. And they learn what it's like to be a Japanese POW.
And I found, like, speaking of your anchors and your characters, I thought that a lot of what their sort of their leader, Nurse Cobb, was really interesting. Some of the things she tried to get, she got away with and she was able to do in sort of her leadership role. So can you talk a little bit about her as an individual and as a sort of leader of this group?
Yeah, so I loved Chief Nurse Cobb. Her name's Laura May Cobb. She's originally from Kansas, and she was almost about 50 years old at the time she was taken prisoner of war. And she was a very firm and fair but terse person, very calm, very cool, but pretty critical of her younger nurses. And that's important to note because Dorothy, my main subject, is not fond of her chief nurse. So whenever you see them in pictures, it's almost funny to see Dorothy's on one side, Cobb is on the other side. But the other thing you will notice about Cobb in the photographs is she always stands slightly in front of her nurses. And so that's what she was doing the full war, is looking for ways to protect her nurses. She is looking for eventually extra fabric, money to help them survive, to buy supplemental food, anything she can do to secure something better for her nurses. But what you're referring to, early on in their captivity, they realize that the Japanese military, they just pilfer. They take whatever they want. And she realizes they're going to come for their supply of malaria medicine. And so she can't hide it. That would be a reason to be executed. And she can't ask her nurses to hide it. And so what she does is she changes it with baking soda. And it's brilliant. So she just mislabels all the malaria medicine and then swaps it out with the labels with baking soda. So when the Japanese military comes to take the malaria medicine, they actually take baking soda.
She does this like a couple, like she smuggles medicine, she smuggles reports at one point, and they,
yes,
right, and there is a point where Dorothy was like, why is she wearing that? And finds out that it's because she's smuggling reports.
Yes, that's actually, you know, it's kind of another funny moment in the book where, Dorothy doesn't realize until later that the Japanese military was going to initially divide the nurses. And Cobb is working behind the scenes to keep her women together. She's doing it for a couple of reasons. One, she is still hopeful that some of them will be repatriated. So she doesn't want to risk them being broken into groups and one group not being repatriated. And then eventually they're kept together, but they're sent to civilian concentration camp. And so what she does is, because records are forbidden, she puts them under her uniform. But on her chest, they form this incriminating square. They look like documents under fabric. And so she puts on a flower lei. And this is so funny. The Japanese don't even pay attention to them. But they're standing outside waiting to be transported to the concentration camp. And Dorothy's looking at her chief nurse, and she sees her wearing a lei. And she's just irritated. Like, we're not going to a party. We're going to a concentration camp. Why are you dressed up? You know, that kind of, and one of the nurses has to whisper to her, this is actually, she's keeping our records. And the records are very important because one day they were given to the Navy, and the Navy eventually did acknowledge the women with pay, although they did not receive as much as the men did. And they did not receive, in my opinion, all the medals that they should have received, but they were acknowledged due to these records. So Cobb was quite the hero.
Right. And these women, I mean, it wasn't like they were just positioned in one concentration camp either. They were moved around often during this time and had to sort of fend for themselves in many different situations and make sure that they were okay in many situations. They were, you know, sick. There was one point, I think, in the same sort of that same year where Dorothy had gotten hepatitis, I think it was. And
yeah, she had hepatitis. She had her appendix burst almost. They had a lot of ailments among them. One woman had a heart attack. several had undiagnosed tuberculosis, heart conditions, a lot of issues that they persevered with. So they were in three camps. And what's interesting about each of the camps was at a former college. So the first one was the Women's Music College in Manila. And then they were transferred to University Santo Tomas in March of 1942. And they remained there until May of 1943. And that's when the camp commander was setting up a countryside camp at an agriculture college in near Los Baños and wanted 800 volunteers to actually go build the camp because they weren't going to let them in the buildings. They were going to live outside, essentially, in fields. And so the Navy nurses at that point, when asked by a surgeon, agreed to go and be the medical care providers. And what's interesting about that is, number one, they were going into the unknown, so it was a great risk on their part. And then two, the surgeon they went with was actually repatriated like a month later. So he was associated with the Rockefeller Foundation, and they did a prisoner exchange, like 1% of prisoners were repatriated, maybe even less. And this guy had connections, so he was on the list. So it's kind of interesting that he gets the Navy nurses to go with him. And then he's like, well, it's been nice. And so the Navy nurses were the only medical care providers in that camp for about 5 months. And then they get a surgeon transfers in from another camp. And he, in other books, he was a civilian surgeon. He's really played up as the hero of the camp. And that was not the case. He did good work. He was a caring person. He did a lot for inmates, but it was truly the Navy nurses were the anchors of the camp.
Right. And these nurses too, it seemed, well, a couple things, but one of them was that they were not only really working day in and day out to help people, but they saw a lot of misery. They saw a lot of death. They watched how prisoners and how they were treated. Even, you know, and there's a point where you talk about Chief Nurse Cobb trying to save or trying to protect some of the women from some of the harassment, but they watched how not only the people in the camps are being treated by the Japanese, but how the Japanese military were treating one another. And so you talk a bit too about just those conditions, about, you know, the treatment. And so can you talk a little bit more maybe about some of the things they saw and how they sort of survived that?
Yeah, so this was there was a culture of violence within the Japanese military. If any officer, anybody who was ranked higher than another, could slap someone beneath for insubordination. And so then the nurses come to witness that. They witness the Japanese guards slapping each other, slapping the inmates. And they use the word slap, but these were just hard hits to the jawbone. And after the war, there were Navy officers who were having jaw surgery, having loose molars pulled. There were people who partially lost hearing because of damage to the ear. It was brutal. And, you know, I want to make a point that these Japanese-run POW camps were brutal, right? So we look at the statistics from after the war. And as a point of comparison, if you were an American and you were taken prisoners by the Germans in Europe, there was a 1% death rate if you were an American soldier. If you were an American soldier and you were taken prisoner of war by the Japanese military, there was a 48% death rate. If you were an American civilian and you were taken prisoner of war, it was an 11% death rate. So these were slow-moving concentration camps. They were death camps by starvation and other forms of violence. And all of them, including all the inmates at Los Baños would have been executed if they had not been liberated first. So the 11% was only because the Japanese military just didn't have time to get it higher.
Right. And these women witnessed and watched much of it and were living for years in fear that they could at any point be next.
They were. And what's amazing, too, is they still showed up to work. And they actually, you know, when they feared a massacre, they plotted, you know, how do we run with certain patients? And I think that's just so remarkable that they what they gave to others in the camp, it was unbelievably heroic because it was self-sacrifice. And it was something that they had plenty of time to anticipate, and yet they continue to make the decision to care for others.
Right. And the concentration, and you talk a bit too about sort of some of the ways they sort of helped themselves survive. I thought one of the interesting stories was Nurse Edwina and buying books and sort of renting out books so that she could make some money and get some, because she was told by a doctor, right, that she was just not going to survive.
So it's important to note that in the beginning, this is when they were at the second concentration camp, Santo Tomas, that in the beginning, when the Japanese were winning the war, so we're talking 1942, 1943, about halfway through 44, they're a lot more mild with the prisoners. So they're allowed to do things like purchase items from the Japanese-run canteen. They're allowed to receive care packages from friends and family in Manila. And then they have this secondary economy, right? So if you get the resources you need to make candy, then you can apply for a permit and set up in one of the hallways, and you can sell your goods. So poor Nurse Edwina, she was from Pasadena, and she wasn't doing well. She was a little fragile emotionally at the time, too, which is really quite sensible and fair. And she was told by a doctor, you're not well, and you will not survive the war. And that was very odd because at the time, and well through the 60s into the 70s, the medical community would not fully disclose the diagnosis to a patient because it was considered bad for morale. That people should not know what they had if they were terminal. And so she was told she was going to die, which was not protocol. And so she thought, well, if I could just get more food, I'm so hungry, then if I could get money for food, maybe I could survive. So she had these books, and the other nurses helped her, and they kind of bartered and trade, and they got about 200 books, and they made the Anchor Library. So they put little blue anchors on it, and then they helped Edwina loan out books. And then she used the money to buy food, and she'd share with other nurses, particularly because she had to rest a lot. They would sit at a table on her behalf and man the operation, and then she would you know, share with them. So early on, this type of enterprising, this was possible. But by the end, the last days of 44 into 1945, they were getting 500 calories every other day. So at that point, the death was accelerating at that point. So most of the deaths we see came in those final 4 to 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Another really interesting thing that you sort of highlight, or we see throughout the book, is how little privacy, if any, that they have in these camps, just how crowded they were and sort of the living conditions. And so can you talk a little bit about that as well?
So they, when they were at Santo Tomas, they had about one toilet for every 110, 112 people. So if you were a prisoner at Santo Tomas, your day would begin. They would play the overhead music, wake everybody up, and you probably stayed in either a classroom that had hundreds of other people jammed into it, or if you were a man, maybe in one of the gymnasiums. And so you had a bed, you were given though 22 square feet. So essentially it's your bed and then right next to you is someone else. So after you were woken up, you would likely go stand in the toilet line. And when it was your turn to use the toilet, there's about five or six lined up, no stalls. So imagine that. And then if you decided you wanted to shower that day, you would get in the shower line and there would be again, no, it would be about, you know, if you're a woman, about five or six women around one spigot. So some of the nurses, they would get up so early, like 4:30 in the morning to go use the shower. They had a little more privilege to move about because they worked at the infirmary. So after you showered, if you decide to do that, then you would go get in the food line at the camp kitchen. And it would just be really meager, maybe some rice or some sort of corn mush. In the beginning, you might get a few vegetables or even a duck egg, although that dissipated at the end. And then inmates were supposed to do something to contribute to the camp. The nurses worked. Some inmates, you know, maybe they peeled potatoes or did some cleanup. A lot of people weren't very, you know, into it. And when there's 3,100 inmates, you can kind of slip by. And so there was no privacy. Everything was just in front of everyone else. So if you were in that camp at one point, you cried in front of other people, you were humiliated, used the bathroom in front of other people. And this is really important to note because towards the end of the war, the camp commander decides he wants to humiliate the inmates and get at their pride. And so he tries to like have them register and have their photograph taken. And in his mind, he thinks that when they're photographed, it'll be really demoralizing. But he didn't realize, you know, they'd been using the toilet in front of each other for years. So the humiliation, that ship had sailed. And so what's kind of in a funny moment is like the Americans end up for registration just like making up these really, you know, funny addresses, you know, obscene words or like whatever they knew the Japanese military wouldn't recognize as obscene. And then they would use that as their street name. So you can just imagine, you know, plug it in yourself, what they were probably coming up with. And then they would tell each other later, like, oh, I went with, you know, so, you know, there's a couple moments in the book, you know, the lighter moments come up, but just simply because of who people are, mm-hmm. And how they respond, sometimes as best as they can to a situation. But it is a war book.
Yeah. No, the, another interesting, when you moved into 1943, I think it is, the Army and Navy nurses are together and the Army nurses are talking about going on strike. I think it is. And can you talk a little bit about sort of that situation as well?
Yeah, so the Army nurses didn't come into the camp until later in 42 because they'd been on Bataan and Corregidor. And then when they were transferred in, taken prisoner, they were actually isolated and they were put into an old convent. But as the prison got more crowded, they had what they called an executive committee, right? So the Japanese military left a lot of the day-to-day running to the actual inmates. So they had an executive committee. An executive committee, because of overcrowding, wanted to move the Army nurses out of this convent. And it was pretty good real estate for them. So they weren't going to give it up. And so they wanted a strike, but it was really risky, right? Because if they... it could just not work out for them, right? They could lose everything, including, you know, would they still be needed at the infirmary? How would that work out? So what they did is they targeted my subject Dorothy because she had gone to nursing school in California with one of the Army nurses. So they had the Army nurse approach Dorothy and kind of suggest, well, we won't be showing up. And Dorothy, of course, she never heard of that. She was worried about the patients. So she went promptly to her chief nurse and said, you know, put me on, I'll do it. And then with that, Cobb went to the executive committee. And so the Army nurses ended up getting what they wanted. because of this threat of a strike and poor Dorothy being used as a pawn. And so I should note that Dorothy, the Army and Navy nurses were just really different cultures. They got along, they did their work, but they much preferred their own.
And it's in 1943 when they are transferred then to Los Baños. And so that, even that experience of being transferred, they were a little worried. Yes, and you said this earlier, but they thought, like, they were unclear as to what this was going to be like. It could be a really great situation. It could not. And at first, I think it seemed like they were really frightened that they were being sent basically to death.
They were, that was actually legitimate fear, because later on in the war, entire camps were slaughtered. But they did. They kind of wondered. It was just pitched to them in such a way where they had to be suspicious, because the camp commander got on the overhead speaker and he told them, "We're building this camp. It is going to be," and I kid you not, he uses the phrase, "ideal health resort." And the campers are like, "Oh no." I shouldn't say campers, because they were prisoners of war. They were inmates. So the inmates, they were very concerned it was a trap, because they're promised, "You can grow vegetables and we're going to start with 800 men. But eventually, when women are transferred, families can live together." At that point in time, men and women were segregated by sex. So, you know, if you were married, you weren't together. And so they're throwing all these things out at them, like food, hygiene, chance to be with your family. And after, you know, a year and a half of being a prisoner of war, you have no reason to trust that they would give you the things you want most. So no one wanted to go. And you have all these people trying to get out of the draft. And then meanwhile, the Navy nurses realize, when they're approached by the Rockefeller physician, if we don't go, there will be no medical care. And they didn't like the thought of 788 men without anyone to, you know, put a supping on a sprain, or to, you know, anything like that, you know, to help them if they had a fever, nothing like that. And they agreed to go.
And I think it was shortly after they got there, there was another story that I thought was really fun about capturing the chicken.
Oh yeah. So this is, they get to Los Baños and they see that a chicken made the mistake of coming into, I'm sorry, one second. There's a squirrel on my, I think it wants in my attic. I'm sorry. One second.
Yeah.
See, that you can't be missing. And, okay, I think I lost that battle. I'm going to have to deal with that later. These poor women, they transfer to Los Baños and they're put in unventilated boxcars for the journey. And I mean, even cattle travels in ventilation, and these women are not given that. And so they get to the camp. And they have to spend the night outdoors. And then the next day, they're allowed to start building their facilities. And they spot that a flock of chickens has just absentmindedly wandered into, you know, under the barbed wire. And they see this opportunity that if they could catch one, they could have chicken stew. And so one of the nurses, this quiet nurse named Eldine Page, originally from South Dakota and then moved to a farm in California, she knew how to walk among chickens. And so she actually slinks over and she sees one of the birds is debilitated and she grabs it. And they have stew that night and they're helped by one of their nurses. One of the 12 is actually a Filipina who is amazing, because she's technically not a Navy nurse and she could have left them at any time and she never did. And so she helps them, you know, kills the bird and takes care of plucking it and doing all the things that some of the other women might not have been familiar with.
And they got to eat.
They got to eat.
I know, but it was really great too to think about. Like, I mean, I don't know if it was great, but I just loved that idea. Like, we're going to go out there, we're going to get it, and then we're going to use sort of every bit of this, and we're going to make broth and all the different ways that they thought of using all the parts of the chicken.
It was all useful to them. You know, the feathers they could use. You could stuff a pillow with that, or everything had value to them. Everything had value at that point.
And it seemed that they finally also had a bit more, the new doctor came in, Dr. Nance, and they had a bit more, brought surgical equipment. They were a little leery of him, but they still had some equipment, a bit more room in the hospital. And they also trained some men to help them do their work.
Yeah, that was actually Dorothy's idea. She came up with the idea. Because in the Navy, they had what were called corpsmen, and they had corpsmen, and that's what they were used to. They were like orderlies, nurses. They assisted nurses, they assisted pharmacists, dentists, doctors. I should say they were more trained. They had more medical knowledge than orderlies, but they needed corpsmen, and since they didn't have any, they came up with Dorothy came up with a training program where they would try to teach some basics to volunteers. And then these men would essentially be their orderlies. And, they had some rough patches getting them adjusted. But it was pretty, ingenious, which is, I think, a great way to describe these Navy nurses, because they were so resourceful. They had great ideas for how they were setting up the infirmary, because I want to stress this, the infirmary was stripped bare. They didn't even have cupboards. There had been two armies that had passed through during the different battles. The American army went through first, and then the Japanese army went through next, and they just stripped that college bare. So the infirmary itself, it was just walls and a staircase. And then I think they had a few things that were bolted to the floor that weren't taken, essentially a surgical table, but that was it. And so the nurses had to create everything. We're talking bed frames, sheets, pillows, bandages, anything. They had to be resourceful. And so they, certainly relied quite a bit on their Filipina nurse, Basilia. And then these were women from the Great Depression. They knew how to sew. They knew how to garden. They had a lot of self-reliant skills that they used to benefit the entire infirmary.
And another thing that you sort of highlight throughout the book, and it's interesting when you get to sort of the end in the epilogue, when you talk about sort of what happened after that, there was also, even though the men and women were supposed to be separated, this was, war, life or death. And there was also time for romance and falling in love, and Dorothy included. But many of these women fell in love and either married or not, but with people that they had been in the concentration camps with. So can you talk a little bit about that, too?
Sure. Yeah. So when they first get to Los Baños, there's 788 men and 12 nurses. And so the nurses are really in demand. You can imagine there's one, Mary Rose, and she there's a picture of the book. She has this beautiful red hair, and she's from South Dakota. And there's the man who eventually became her husband. He was an American working for the U.S. Treasury in Manila when he was taken prisoner. And he really is so in love with Mary Rose that he gets a job as one of the orderlies. And then he cleans out a room in the basement, the infirmary basement, for him and a couple other guys. So he's just like always around, he's always making sure, he's by his Mary Rose and keeping potential suitors away from his nurse. In the beginning, in May 1943, it wasn't violent. It was eventually that camp would grow to have 3,100 people. And eventually that camp would have a lot of problem inmates. Because Sandro Tomas, whenever there was a draft, if you can get rid of 500 inmates and you can get rid of your biggest problem people, right? The people who have criminal tendencies, the people who are mentally ill, the people who don't get along with others, well, you just ship them off. But in the beginning, there's only 800 of them. So they weren't cramped. The lines weren't as bad. And the commander in charge of the camp was not sadistic. So in the beginning, it wasn't terribly bad. And so they had time to form affections with each other. And so even the chief nurse Cobb, who she was in her 50s by then, and she formed a strong friendship with a New Zealand ship captain who was in his 60s, and he would humor the children with his pirate stories and just kind of this nice old guy. And Dorothy was very much pursued by another Californian. He was also from Southern California. He was a civilian pilot who was taken prisoner of war and sent to the camp, and was very interested in Dorothy. And that was a little problematic because he was actually married. And so that added on a layer of heartbreak for her, because when they were in the camp, you know, they were together there for almost 2 years in the camp together. And at that point, they don't know, will we ever go home? What will happen? And so ties at home were very much forgotten. And this relationship, his name was Thomas, was extremely important to her. And this was the person she talked to, who she relied upon, who was the person who understood her on the days that she felt inhuman. And, you know, at the end of the war, that's just ripped from her. And that's extremely painful. But for many of the other nurses, one woman named Goldia, she married another inmate directly after the war. And then Mary Rose, her and her husband, they got married within 2 months of liberation. They got married on Friday the 13th. And the priest said, "Are you sure you don't want to wait?" And they said, "It's the only day you have open, and we've waited for so long."
So they have, by the time we get to 1944, they just are not sure they're going to get out alive. And I think there's one point where letters and packages are showing up, and they realize that those care packages are not going to the Americans, just the British prisoners of war. So can you talk a little bit about that ending and the feel, what was happening and what was going on with them by that time?
So, you know, they truly almost did not survive this war. All the inmates at Los Baños survived by 6 hours. If there had been a 6-hour difference in their liberation, it would have been 3,100 massacred inmates. So they almost did not survive. And mail, whenever it comes through the Red Cross, and the instructions are so difficult to understand that very often people at home are trying to write letters or trying to send things, and it's not getting through. And there's one occasion where everybody's surrounding, you know, who's getting mail, and people are so hopeful, will my name be called? And it's only for the British inmates. And you know, you have mostly Americans and British, but you also have some Australian inmates, Dutch, French, anybody who was from an allied country, Chinese. And it's really devastating. And then the next time the mail comes around, you know, Dorothy gets like 2-3 letters at once in a package. So that was extremely important to them, to let them know you still exist outside this camp. This is potentially not permanent, and there might be a life for you outside what is overwhelmingly feels like the end of your life is being in the camp.
Right. And then we get to the end. And like you said, like they were almost dying, right? There's bombings that are happening that they're worried. They're hunting for survivors throughout these camps as we get to the end of 1944. And so can you talk a little bit about sort of those final days and those final hours and eventually being liberated from these camps?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So and by the end of the war, towards the end of 1944, the Allied forces are winning and they're taking back key islands in the South Pacific. And the Japanese military responds with their prisoners of war in the Philippines, primarily by shipping the military POWs to Japan in slave labor camps. And so their thought behind this is, if we lose the Philippines, if we lose the occupation, we do not want to do it in front of our prisoners, number one. And then number two, the prisoners, when liberated, could be quickly fed, rehabilitated, and then turned into fighting machines. So they ship a lot of the men to Japan. And then for those who are not shipped, they begin massacres. And so the book covers the massacre at Palawan, in which 150 military POWs were lit on fire. And several survived and reported to a guerrilla headquarters and then were connected with the American resistance. And at that point, they decided to begin liberating the POW camps because it was very clear that the Japanese military had plans to massacre both civilian and military. So when they get to one called Cabana Chuan, this is where the survivors of the death Bataan Death March were placed. There's only about 500 of them left. They're in terrible condition. And they're in occupied territory when the Allies liberate. So they need to get them out of this camp immediately. And the survivors are so wrecked that they don't believe it's happening. And so they think that it's actually Germans playing a trick on them. And so what the Allied forces learn, and this is repeated again at Santo Tomas in January, is that these prisoners of war do not behave in a way as predictable. So they do things like they want to eat, they don't want to leave, they want to pack, they want to ask questions, you know, why doesn't your uniform resemble what I remember? Because U.S. had indeed changed uniforms when the war began. So the military men did not recognize the new uniforms. They didn't, you know, they were, where are you from in California? If you're really from California, how do I know you're not German? So this was not what the U.S. military had planned. Now, for Dorothy and all of them at Los Baños, they were also in occupied territory. There was no strategic advantage to the U.S., so they had to wait all the way until late February of 1945 for liberation. And so the night before they are liberated, the Japanese military sets up machine guns around the perimeter of the camp and then turns the barrels inward. And so at this point, the inmates, they were suspecting they were going to be killed. And they're trading information, you know, you should run or you should play dead, trying to help each other survive. You know, this is how I think I could best survive if this happens. And so Dorothy and Peg Nash are due on the night shift at the infirmary, and Chief Nurse Cobb expects them to go. And they do, which is, again, going back to how remarkable these women were and how committed they were that, you know, here's a chance. This could potentially be your last night on Earth, and, you know, you're working the night shift. So they were on duty the next morning at dawn during liberation.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too, you have pictures throughout just looking at the pictures of these women once they are released and just how emaciated they all are. And then how they're sort of treated in some ways once they are released. And one other thing that was interesting for me too was you talked a bit about how they, like we started using penicillin, for example, they started to learn about all the things that they could have used and would have been really useful for them during these years in concentration camps. So can you talk a bit about that transition for them and what that was like once they were liberated?
Yeah, sure. So they, it's important for people to remember that these women were taken prisoner in January 2nd, 1942. So they're essentially, their last outside contact with the war world was December of 1941. So they're essentially paused in 1941. They miss everything that goes on in the outside world. Sometimes they get newspapers, but it'll be, you know, for things that are not helpful to them, like, you know, fashion and recipes. And their medical knowledge is paused in 1941. So when they get out and so they're liberated and they all weigh less than 100 pounds and they all have these major medical issues. Yet they are needed where they're liberated. They're brought to Bilibid prison and they're asked to nurse other liberated prisoners, because it's kind of a staging area for getting people back to the U.S. or for those who are staying in Manila. They have to wait till the Battle of Manila is over. So they're nursing casualties from the Battle of Manila. They're nursing other inmates. And they're learning from the Army just how far behind they are, right? So all this single-use stuff, in terms of supplies, different tubing, different needles. They hadn't done that in years. Penicillin would have just solved so many of their problems in the camp, and they had not had any exposure to it. They even during liberation, they had never seen a Jeep. So they were being reintroduced to the world. And what was hard about it is that their reintroduction was really framed by the news media as girls coming back from camp. And so from they're in this, you know, they're at Bilibid for about a week or two. And then finally Chief Nurse says enough, you know, these women need rest. We're going home. So they begin traveling back to the U.S. and they have to take about five different planes, go through the different islands. And every time they land, it's interviews with reporters, it's photographs, and they're being used for propaganda purposes, right? Because the U.S. still has, another 5-6 months left in the war, still signed war bonds. And what a better way to do that than a beautiful nurse who was a POW and can motivate Americans to give. And so they kind of concoct this story that really, you know, presents them as girls who are roughing it. They're back home from camp. And one headline even says how they're not picky about spam anymore. Like, ha, ha, ha. You know, that's terrible. These women were, they're military veterans. They were military heroes. And they were being denied, I think, the reception they deserved.
Right. And we've been talking a while. So you end the book with this sort of epilogue and sort of talking a bit about what these anchors, these sort of major characters that you bring up, sort of what their life was like after the war, giving us little snippets. So is there any of those that you want to highlight or, you know, share?
Yeah, so I want to share, because this to me is the crux of the book and the crux why I hope listeners in this podcast will support this book, either by, you know, buying it yourself or asking your local library to please buy a copy, is that when the war was over and she was doing the war bond tour, she badly had PTSD and she was crying without provocation. And when she cried, it was very difficult to stop. And so she had, she was dating at that point a naval officer who she ended up marrying. And he told her to go see the naval psychiatrist and to try to get a medical discharge. And she went to the naval psychiatrist and she described all that she went through. And the Navy psychiatrist denied her. He said that because she was a woman, that she was a liar and a fake, and she did not suffer. And that really shut her up. Her son told me that whenever she was asked about it, she would either only bring up, you know, the funny moments, like the things we discussed, or she would make it sound like she'd gone to Girl Scout camp, when in reality, she was a military hero. And I'm sorry, my earpiece fell out. In reality, she was a military hero, and she was denied that in her lifetime, that acknowledgement. And so what I hope to do with this book, and what I hope readers will support, is women's history and correcting a history that has not been fully told. Because right now, our take on history suffers from this. We have only one viewpoint. It belongs to one certain type of person, and everybody else is just on the periphery. And we are still at a point in time where we can crack this for future generations by broadening the lens of how a story is told. And by including women, we broaden the lens. So I very much hope, if listeners, like I said, if you don't buy the book, please ask your university library or your local library to buy a copy. Most librarians are typically pretty happy to accommodate a request so that we can get this story into the collective memory. And we can add to history and make it more diverse and therefore more correct.
Yes. No, I completely agree. I think it's fascinating, really important. Even in just looking at some of the images and some of the photos, we see so many photos, but these are not ones even that we often see when we think about World War II and what was happening in the Pacific. During this time. So, you know, it's these stories, it's these images, it's this history of these women who none of the women are still alive, but many of their children are, and people who,
the people that they cared for. And I think it's these women are a story about humanity at its best. Mm-hmm. And we often seek inspiration from our historical figures. And I think that we can see inspiration in female historical figures mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And we should. And I think it's just about broadening the space so that the narrative isn't just one viewpoint as to who was involved and who made a contribution and who shaped the world we live in now. Because these women did too.
So this book just came out. I don't know if you're working on anything else or if you have any upcoming dates where you're talking about the book or anything, any sort of last things you'd like to share about what you're either working on or what's coming up with this book.
Well, everything else is in such a preliminary stage. It'll be more women's history, more correcting narratives that I feel have been mistold because they were defined by a narrow viewpoint. But right now, just focusing on making sure as many people as possible know about the 12 anchors. I do a lot of speaking in libraries. I have some nursing symposiums that have asked me to speak, and just trying to tell as many people as possible about this story. And I'd love to see this made into a young adult version. Mm. So that's kind of something that I've seen it done with other books, and I'd like to see it done with this one. I know that it's a hard story and it's a war book, but I don't know what kids like. They
love that.
All these like, yeah. And then don't they watch like these like war, like Hunger Games and stuff like that. So figure if you can handle that, can handle the 12 anchors.
Again, so Emily, thank you. This was Emily LeBeau-Lucchesi, and the book is This Is Really War, The Incredible True Story of a Navy Nurse POW in the Occupied Philippines. Thank you so much for talking to me about your book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Again, this is Rebecca Buchanan, co-host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. Thanks for listening.